Welcome to In Search of Wisdom, a podcast by the Perennial Leader Project. On today's episode, my guest is Jason Murchie, the author of Wisdom, a Very Valuable Virtue That Cannot Be Bought. Jason is the founder of Values of the Wise, author of 5 books, and someone with a deep interest in ancient philosophy, virtue ethics, and human nature. In the conversation, Jason and I discuss practical philosophy, the wisdom of doubt and skepticism, finding balance between knowing and not knowing, what we can know for sure, the value of quotes and aphorisms, wisdom in daily life, and so much more. I really enjoyed the conversation, and before we get to the episode, I want to encourage you to check out Jason's website, which is valuesofthewise.com. He has a quote database that I think you're going to enjoy. You can type in any keyword, wisdom, for example, and get a huge list of quotes connected to your topic from ancient philosophy to present day. It's really impressive, so check it out. All right, without any further delay, please welcome the wise and gracious Jason Murchie. Jason, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here. I always enjoy talking with somebody who cares not only about wisdom, as you do, but also quotations, which not every philosopher who's interested in big ideas thinks that quotations are particularly valuable or interesting or reliable. So I'm glad we're discussing this stuff.
Nice. Me too. And I said last time we got together that I may have found someone that likes quotations more than I do, which is a strong statement. But I'm excited today to discuss your book, Wisdom, A Very Valuable Virtue That Cannot Be Bought. But before we get into the book, we generally start off with some sort of question around what started you on this path to searching for fill in the blank. And in this case, we'll say wisdom.
Well, it's a long answer. I'll see if I can hit the high points. I was born Jewish in a relatively Christian area. Southern California. So there was also, a decidedly non-religious influence. But, I always felt a little different than other people since I didn't have we went to the temple on Sundays, but I just kind of felt like that wasn't really a home for me or something. There was just something about it. I don't know. Maybe I was vain and I wanted to hang out with the Baptists at their summer camp, which was the most exciting thing that a kid could do in Downey, California. So I was sort of meant to be relatively unmoored as I grew up. And then when I reached, 15, my parents got divorced. And so from maybe, 10 to 15, there was trouble, there was a storm at sea, in my life. And then finally the divorce was kind of the end of it. And so, I kind of didn't do well in school at that point either. And so I think everything that a child or adolescent would cling to, except for maybe my friends, was either tumultuous or absent or causing me insecurity, et cetera, et cetera. There's also mental illness in my family, so I was coping with that as a teenager, not just within myself, because obviously those things are, passed on to some degree genetically, but also because my father was quite mentally ill once the divorce had occurred and my mother had moved far away. So I was living with my dad going to junior college, and it was just kind of a tough time. That's when I took a philosophy class. I had a philosophy class in my senior year of high school. And then once I reached college, I was like, you know what, I'm going to take philosophy right out of the gate. And I did. And, you know, I also took math and English, and philosophy just seemed like such a wonderful class, a beautiful, it's like this new vista opened up to me, you know, this idea of there's this thing called philosophy and, you know, throughout the centuries, people have been discussing things, arguing about things, trying to find the truth about things, delving into things like justice and goodness and such. I'm just sort of really interested in those values and virtues and what they mean. Since it's a little challenging to find quick and easy definitions for those phenomena. And then of course, how it can be, how philosophy and values and virtues can be utilized to live a better life, a life that is, you know, good, flourishing, et cetera. One based on, you know, things like wisdom and goodness. And that's, you know, it's probably no coincidence that at that point I also began to become quite interested in psychology as a subject and, you know, went on to major in psychology and then get involved in clinical psychology further and further. So it just kind of, I just traveled a path, I guess. Every time there was a momentous decision to be made, I chose one direction and, you know, it did kind of lead me in this rare direction for a person, which is basically where they like these ideas. They try to live the life of the mind to some degree, you know, sort of try to transcend some of the societal values that we have going on or the social problems that we have going on and, you know, live better, be happier, make good decisions when it comes to issues of democracy and leadership and so on and so forth. So I could write a paper on this question, but I think I will stop there and see where you want to go.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing a bit about yourself. If you can think back to that first philosophy class, that's awesome that you were able to take a philosophy class in high school. Was there any particular thinker or ideas or a book that really sparked your interest?
Not necessarily a book. I mean, you know, clearly folks have been terribly influenced by, you know, Plato's Republic and, you know, Aristotle's Ethics and, these types of things. Maybe because I wasn't extremely academically capable or used to rigor in junior college, I didn't, delve into, you know, a book that made a big difference. But I will say that idea-wise, the thing that I mainly picked up from that class, which, you know, my philosophy professor was, you know, he had like a long white beard and he was Irish and Irish American and he had a PhD, which is not necessarily typical in junior college. So I thought this guy was just the best. He had like a gravitas about him. I got a C in the class. So I really looked up to the man and to the subject. And I think one thing that really came across clearly was one should be hesitant about believing things and tentative in their, you know, their worldview, their values, the decisions they make and the beliefs they adopt. And I remember some quotations back from that era because interestingly, he made us memorize quotations, which is probably the first and last time that had occurred in a class. And so there's one, something like, philosophy begins when one, learns to doubt, especially one's cherished, beliefs, opinions, and axioms. I feel like that's probably Will Durant. But, you know, the idea of doubting, being hesitant, kind of like a willingness to hold in abeyance your decision-making, you know, the apparatus in your mind that would say, I need to know things. I need to know the answers to things. I want to know what's going on. I don't like ambiguity. You know, I want to know feel confident, comfortable. You have to kind of keep that in check and manage it because it becomes a kind of emotion, really. That's one of the main principles of philosophy that I recall. As to the second part of your question, you know, were there any people that I, you know, specifically recall? Yes is the answer. And no, I can't probably specify one because it was just such a broad education in regard to, you know, there's so many people out there who I tended to study the Western tradition more than anything, which I guess is kind of typical. And I'm not, you know, myopic. I don't think that the Western tradition is the only thing there is, but I think it's well worth learning. And I think there are great books. I think there are great ideas. And I think that, you know, that holds great power to learn about those things and to know thyself, so to speak, which is kind of a Socratic dictum. But yeah, just all kinds of folks.
Well, I love it. And you mentioned something in there about ambiguity and doubt and uncertainty, not necessarily something that we get too excited about. And that may be true for the listeners as well. So I may have to apologize to the listeners because that was the primary area I wanted to focus on for the conversation. Your book covers a lot of ground. As the listeners to this show know, we've been asking, coming up on 100 people, you know, what is wisdom? It's such a broad topic. And you do a great job in the book, really, really covering so many different areas.
Thank you.
But one chapter really focuses on skepticism and doubt. So I thought we could spend some time there, and we'll see where it leads us. But maybe to begin, what is skepticism? How does it connect with wisdom in your view?
I think it's sort of the tree from which wisdom could possibly grow. You know, yes, there is a way in which one can, you know, arrive at a belief without really being skeptical about that belief. But I think that in that case, it's almost like a little pet idea, a predilection, a preference, an opinion, something along these lines, something that, you know, you can believe it if you want. Obviously, some people, they balloon that concept into having a whole, you know, dogma that they believe in, a set of principles that have been passed down through the centuries from prophets and religious thinkers and gods even. And they believe those things, and that's good. That's fine. However, I think, you know, if skepticism or wisdom sort of represents a tree, you know, you're only going to be able to get to that fruit if it goes through the long, somewhat, careful and rigorous process of being subjected to doubt and skepticism. I do think that it's fair to say that, you know, beliefs should be believed, and opinions should be held, worldviews should be adopted, you know, to the degree that they are resting on something substantive and well considered, well thought out. Critical thinking is a thing, because if we don't think critically, we're just thinking, and the human brain and mind is/are very powerful, almost tricky, or it's just funny. It behaves in a funny way. People believe things that are absolutely not true, and yet they still have a tremendous amount of confidence in those beliefs.
You know, if we think about in daily life, someone today navigating in the world, you know, what does skepticism look like? Any examples come to mind?
Yeah, I like that question because my book is, you know, I'm not a professional philosopher. Psychologists obviously have studied wisdom and, you know, hold PhDs and are just, you know, I have a lot of respect for those individuals. I love the liberal arts, social sciences. So I think the best that I did in my book was kind of give flavors and, you know, try to sketch what it, quote, looks like, you know, wisdom, truth, and then all of the constituents of it that I get into, such as, you know, this chapter we're talking about here, doubt, skepticism, and intellectual humility. Also, there's chapters, you know, such as empathy and compassion, patience and delaying gratification, you know, generosity, love, service to others, things like this. So I think what it looks like in everyday life is really kind of the heart of the book, ideally. And I share some of my own personal remembrances of times in the past when I was, you know, when I sort of came to the point where I learned something about myself or about the world or about human beings that I categorized in my head as being wisdom. If I have not yet, you know, jettisoned that idea, then I consider it to be, you know, fairly tried and true, approaching wisdom, let's say. So I was more than happy to share those remembrances and opinions and ideas with readers. But, you know, clearly there's the religious sphere when it comes to what skepticism looks like. There's the political sphere. There's the sphere of, you know, the intrapersonal one, let's say, what you believe about yourself and, you know, your relationships, the values you hold. Obviously a lot of folks have a, kind of like unquestioning acceptance and love for the country in which they live, et cetera, et cetera. So any of those areas can be subjected to more or less skepticism. You know, just to put it plainly, skepticism to me is basically the idea that you, you regard, potential facts or opinions or ideas, theories with, a tentativeness, a hesitancy to believe it. It's almost as though you're sitting there with your arms crossed saying, okay, show me that this is the truth, you know, demonstrate it to me. What evidence is there? Might you be wrong? Might I be wrong? How do I know that whatever we're talking about is reliable?
How about something you mentioned early on, you know thyself, connected with Socrates and supposedly inscribed at the Oracle at Delphi. I wonder, like, when it comes to skepticism and doubt, can we know ourselves? Or maybe even another example of something, obviously you wrote a book about virtue and you're, you know, you have a website, Values of the Wise. I'm very much proponent of virtues and something we talk about here on the podcast quite a bit. But it's like, can we know that, you know, the Stoics might say virtue is the only good? I don't know if we get curious around these things, like can we know ourselves? Can we know for sure that virtue is, you know, is the path to the good life? How do we know anything?
This is a complicated question in a complicated area. Philosophy is not simple. You know, I think it was somebody like Tennyson or Kipling or somebody said, philosophy, : the purple bullfinch in the lilac tree, which, as you may know, if you know either of those things, a purple bullfinch is purple and a lilac tree has purple flowers. So it's a way to kind of, you know, satirically point out that, you know, philosophy has its strengths and its weaknesses, and it's almost always a challenging process. People should be arguing in philosophy, and I don't necessarily mean, you know, obviously the epitome of argument and whatever the noun for pedantic is. I can't think of it at the moment. They, you know, in the 20th century, the philosophers in America were well known to, you know, be into analytic philosophy. They would argue about words and, you know, quibble and nitpick. And it's almost as though they were just sort of lost in the, you know, in the weeds, a real myopic, impractical, way of philosophizing, and it didn't really serve humanity. Someone once said there's empty is the argument of the philosopher, which does not relieve some human suffering. And, you know, philosophers, I think if they're quote in their ivory towers, debating things back and forth, trying to, you know, be the most scholarly and well-regarded of all of their peers or whatever, it doesn't serve humanity because we have big problems as a species, as a country, as a world. And if the philosophers aren't helping us much, that's a terrible pity. They might be teaching students one class in philosophy, but if the students don't care about it much and the professors argue with each other mostly, that's a terrible shame. So, you know, all this is kind of to say that what you talk about is when you talk about how do we know, can we really know ourselves? Do we really know if virtue is better? These things are absolutely debatable. It kind of depends on who you ask. And if you've asked 100 people on your podcast, then I'm probably the 100th answer. you know, David Hume would be maybe the flag bearer for let's say like uber skepticism or skepticism for skepticism's sake. And yeah, you know, I think I memorized that as he went so far as to say, can you know that the sun will rise tomorrow? The answer to that question, according to, you know, the very skeptical perspective would be, no, you cannot know that. And the practical philosopher, the person who values, you know, phronesis, practical wisdom would say, that's ridiculous. We have to base our lives on the fact that, of course, the sun is going to rise tomorrow. We might be wrong in some sense, you know, maybe a nuclear holocaust happens overnight and we never reach tomorrow, but we have to sort of live as if the sun rises. And so, you know, I don't think that one can prove that we can know ourselves or that knowing ourselves is useful or that virtue is better than vice or lack of virtue or what have you, or that flourishing and eudaimonia is a good thing. But let's live as if those things are true, and let's accept, you know, a 99% confidence, you know, interval in the idea that, you know, maybe we can't know it in the sense that we know something such as 2 + 2 = 4. But, you know, if you know that a piece of music is beautiful and that you love it and that it has merit, it doesn't really matter what David Hume would have said about it. You see what I'm saying? If you're asking my opinion, can we know ourselves? Is virtue better? I would say yes to all of those questions, maybe with a bit of a footnote along the lines of, but let's hold on to those conclusions tentatively, be open to new evidence, and really only believe in such things based on, you know, the utility of it or the evidence for it or, you know, the practical results, you know, how well it kind of pencils out, you know, to use a investing metaphor. It's like if the deal works, the deal works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. So with Kant and, you know, deontology, for example, it's like if you believe that lying is wrong, then don't lie. Is it absolutely true that lying is always wrong? You know, no, probably not. But you can live a very full and good life believing that lying is wrong, or that eating animals is wrong, or that, you know, cheating on your taxes is wrong, or, you know, a list of things that you hold to be, you know, your moral values, your ethical theories. Just find something, get behind it, be consistent, be passionate about it, but also, you know, accept that none of this stuff is carved in stone. You know, I think at the highest level, things like truth, justice, goodness, and wisdom are carved in stone. those things are absolutely true and viable and superior, and they exist. So let's believe in those things.
Is there any benefit, I wonder, like, as you mentioned, you talked about the footnote of believing, but also at the same time having some openness, whether it's knowing yourself, to stick with the examples of knowing yourself and virtue. I don't know. I wonder, is there some importance of knowing that that you're operating on a belief or faith, you know, knowing that, coming to the realization that you can't have necessarily certainty on the cardinal virtues being the path to the good life. We can look back and read a canon and, you know, thousands of wise thinkers who might stress that. But I don't know. Is there a benefit? I think to butcher a Socrates quote, of something along the lines of, you know, wisdom beginning by realizing that we don't quite know fully. Like, how does that, to throw out a difficult question, I apologize, but, you know, how do we navigate that in daily life for someone listening and charting out their path, moving forward?
I think there really is merit to, on the one hand, getting to know yourself, accessing your, you know, your deepest values, beliefs, longings, desires. You know, everybody's made differently due to genetics, environment, and choice. If it floats your boat, then ask yourself, does it hurt anybody else? If not, then that's great. Go for it. That's your thing. You know, feel it. You know, if you want to become a monk, then become a monk. You know, if you think that trying to reach the pinnacle of, you know, your corporation and become the CEO someday is what really moves you and gets you out of bed and just fires you, then do that. You know, Socrates was absolutely famous, notorious maybe, for saying to folks who thought that they knew themselves or the values that they espoused or certain maybe beliefs or political positions, he would challenge them as though he was a horsefly. He would say, you know, well, what about this? Or consider this perspective. How do you know that? Didn't you just contradict yourself? So there really is a reasonable type of skepticism one can subject their own belief system, value system to. You know, it's complicated to know what justice is, for example, in a given case. And every given case is different. And, you know, to some degree, the time and the place matters, the context. I mean, I think contextualism is an important phenomenon that we shouldn't forget about. But just kind of in general, go with what feels right to you and then subject it to a proper skepticism. In that case, you'll be sort of, it's as though you have a Bunsen burner and this liquid in a beaker, and you're burning off the liquid. If the liquid is, let's say, tap water, you know, what's left is going to be just some powder that is basically minerals. The impurities are left behind. But in this metaphor, you know, it's, you've burned off everything else, and what's left is what is important. So I wouldn't consider them to be impurities. I'd say, you know, that's the good stuff, is what you've distilled your belief system, set of values, worldview, political ideology, religious belief system, that you've sort of really thought about it over and over again, and you've subjected it to conversations with other folks who don't necessarily believe how you believe, gone through some challenges, you know, folks who were properly, if I could use that phrase, or let's say properly justified in their religious belief system, their spirituality, they didn't, you know, find it written on a fortune cookie. You know, they have gone through challenges and they've doubted. It's like a crucible of doubt is how you should be thinking of your religion. You know, I don't think it's appropriate to just absorb what you are being told from your pastor named John or, you know, Rebecca or whatever, and be like, what they're telling me makes perfect sense. I love it. You know, I'm all into it. Or if you're, you know, Jewish, we've been doing this for 5,000 years. I mean, we're good. We got it. You know, you need to go further than that and subject it to, you know, a fair and well-intentioned, you know, doubt where you ask questions. How do I know this is true? What alternatives are there? How confident can I be in this? What would it mean if I were wrong about this? You know, questions such as this.
I like it. I jotted down a quote that you write in the book. You talk about how your point of view comes down on the side that holds that wisdom is only gained through doubt and mental rigor. Is this the mental rigor that you're talking about, this distilling it down and making it your own?
Yes, that's the mental rigor. And it's something that I think is advisable, but in recommending, you know, doubt, skepticism, intellectual humility, and mental rigor, I would say it's not necessarily the easy path. I guess the hardest path would be just being lost, and experiencing some sort of sense of, I mean, the folks who commit mass shootings, they're completely lost. You know, they're lost in their emotions, their anger. They feel, you know, belittled and helpless and hopeless, and they act out. That's probably the worst. Next in line might be, you know, you believe things that you've been told or taught, and you're not exactly sure of those things or happy with them, but it is the way it is. You know, maybe some of the religions that are particularly strict, you know, religious sects that say, you're a woman, you're supposed to walk behind me, or when I say you get pregnant, you get pregnant. Things like this. That would be a kind of, I don't know, objectionable belief, a way of believing in a higher power or, you know, spirituality. As you go up the ladder, you know, you start to think, I've been through some stuff with my belief system. I've doubted it. I've strayed. I've, you know, had times when I cried. I was so unsure, or I couldn't understand why I would be asking God for something he wouldn't be answering me, et cetera, et cetera. And you work through it and you arrive at something that makes sense to you and that you believe in. You know, my wife is just absolutely convinced that God exists. She prays to him. I don't know if him is the right word. I think she thinks it's more of like a force, but she does use Catholic Christianity as a way to approach the infinite or whatever you would call God. And it, you know, I would never want to take that from her. I sometimes tease her a tad, but, it works for her because it's well conceived. You know, she'll say something like, yeah, of course I believe in birth control. Like, you know, maybe shake her head like, gosh, you know, the Catholic dogma about birth control is silly, you know, whatever, just kind of like well thought out, belief system that provides meaning for her, that doesn't harm anybody else, and that provides satisfaction and consolation and a structure. Humans really do like structure, and it's probably harder to, you know, at this highest level, in my opinion, to be agnostic and to be politically moderate and not really have tribal membership or not really get a lot of support, respect, or adulation from other people in society. It's kind of the way of self-actualization and, you know, the way of the strong, I would say.
How did you see skepticism just connecting with basic humility? You mentioned intellectual humility. There's a quote in the book from Epictetus that's really popular. It's impossible for someone to learn what they think they already know. Could we think about skepticism as just, there's still more to learn. There's a, you know, a thread of just basic standard humility in there, or is that too simplified?
No, I think it is what the philosophers would call epistemic humility. Epistemology is the study of knowledge, how we know things, put in its simplest form. And, if it's difficult to know what is true, like capital T true, which is, we didn't really label it as such, but we've been discussing truth a lot throughout this dialogue. And then, of course, some of the small T truths, maybe the findings of a scientific study is a small T truth. You know, it's the folks who have performed rigorous analysis accompanied by statistics and, a thorough grounding in what folks before them have thought and done and found, that holds water. It has merit, but it's a small T truth. So I think, when you look at all of the evidence that folks can be wrong, in fact, the Dunning-Kruger effect in psychology indicates that the more wrong you are, the more confident you tend to be. These blowhards who think they know everything about one topic or another, typically nowadays it involves like political, cultural topics of debate. They feel like they know everything. And if really subjected to, a fine analysis, you would realize that they're not being humble enough. They haven't the ground on which their beliefs are based or their thinking rests is really more like sand than bedrock. And yet, ironically, they're so confident about it. And there's an interesting quote by Voltaire. I'm paraphrasing him. If somebody can make you believe absurdities, they can make you commit atrocities. So the person who can be, influenced by propaganda or conspiracy theories or tribalism or, simple ideology, they can be made to believe those things like that. And it reaches absurd levels at times. And then they're only one step away from committing an absurdity, committing an atrocity. So that's as far as I'll go into politics, at your request. However, in the book, I do get into, many examples of these things that come to us from politics and economics, and so on, because I think those are interesting cases in point. Just in general, I think if you have a humble attitude about what you know or what you think you know, it makes it a lot easier, frankly, to be around you. makes it easier for you to change, to grow. Churchill, if you can't change yourself, you can't change anything. And yet some people, they hold on so tightly to what they believe, the content of what they believe, the minutiae, the little belief systems that they've come to know over the years, they hold on to it rigidly.
Well, let me ask to stay with this. If we're thinking about maybe navigating a balance between doubting and knowing, how does someone know that they're too far on the side of doubting? They're too much of a skeptic. Is it possible to go too far?
I don't think it happens in modern America. Not really. Even the Dalai Lama, who is, he just exudes wisdom. He kind of does think he knows what he knows. You know what I mean? He's not plagued by doubt. Buddha said that the answers lie within and that you shouldn't take my word for it. But, he didn't fail to come up with a belief system and a set of steps. And you know what I mean? So I don't think anybody is really lost in doubt. I think there is a tradition in philosophy to be skeptical just because you're like obsessed with skepticism, with saying, are we even are we even awake right now? Are we having a dream? Am I having a dream that I'm talking to you, and I'm, or am I just a disembodied human brain in a vat of liquid with, you know, all these little electrodes coming off of it and whatever, these mad scientists walk around and look at everybody's brain, you know, like something out of the X-Files. It's like, we can probably dispense with that. You know, maybe if we work at Cambridge as a philosopher, that might be interesting to talk about, but you know, we got more interesting things to think about. I think, you know, the trolley problem in philosophy, right? That thought experiment. I'm sure you've discussed it on your podcast. Maybe some of your listeners know of it. I mean, that's a rich vein of ethics that is very fruitful to get into, rather than something sort of abstruse, like, are we really here? Are we really having this conversation? Can we really know anything? Is everything futile? You know, we're talking about nihilism. That's kind of a cul-de-sac, at least in the practical sense, in the real world. It's not going to help Americans do better than we've been doing lately.
Yeah. But let me ask, as we start to wrap up, I wanted to talk about happiness here. You have a quote in the book from, I may pronounce this incorrectly, but from Ernest Dimnet, the author of Art of Thinking. And it says, our ancestors were happier than we are. The less one knows, the happier one is. And that seems counterintuitive. I'm just curious if you had any thoughts to elaborate on that.
Yes, I did bring that up from time to time in the book. I like to bring up a view that I don't necessarily subscribe to, or a quote that I don't necessarily love, you know, maybe for the purposes of, I don't know, creating like a bit of a contrast, or I don't know, like St. Augustine, for example, said, faith is to believe what we do not see. And the reward of this faith is to see what we believe. Yeah, I put that in there not because I think that is advisable or true, but because it's an interesting counterpoint, or, you know, it kind of creates the entire panorama, let's say, to be like, well, here's a different way of looking at things. So, you know, it's been a while since I've read Dimnet's book, and I can't say that I do or do not, you know, appreciate his book or the theories in his book. I do know that quotation is interesting. Maybe it doesn't, like, sometimes when I read a quote, it's sort of like hitting a gong with a mallet. You know, it's like, wow, I love that. I believe in it. And I absolutely feel that deeply. You know, one, for example, how about Daniel Kahneman, the well-known psychologist? Our comforting conviction that the world makes sense rests on a secure foundation, our almost unlimited ability to ignore our ignorance. I mean, that's a beautiful concept, and well put. And so that, I hear a gong when I read that. The Dimnet quote, a little more questionable. You know, I think it's true to say that we've kind of gotten ourselves into a bit of a fix in society. You know, we're talking about billionaires traveling in space. We're talking about nearly destroying our environment. We're talking about maybe entering the metaverse or virtual reality in the future. Tribalism just kind of run amok. So clearly something in modern society, at least in America, is not working right. And we probably would have been happier at times in the past. Whether we were happier when we were, let's say, you know, maybe a million years ago, you know, gathering berries or something. I don't know if we were happier then, if that was a true type of happiness. Maybe we were unhappy because we had, you know, a kidney stone and we're like, what the hell is that? I don't know what I'm feeling. This is not good. You know, those folks tended to die when they were like 30. So I'm not sure if happier is the ideal way to look at it. But I do think that modern society is really weird. As Martin Luther King put it, we've got guided missiles and misguided men, you know. It's as though we've, I think it was E.O. Wilson who said the weird thing about humans is that we're having to deal with is that we've got, you know, a Paleolithic brain, medieval institutions, and modern technology. See, so when you combine all that, you know, our brain is really just a lizard brain with a more sophisticated brain on top of it. So, you know, I think there's a lot of evidence that we're just not really quite ready for the progress that has occurred in the last, 4,000 years or 7,000 years, something like that. We went from, agriculture and domesticating animals to where we are right now very fast, especially on an evolutionary scale. And I think there's evidence that we're slipping and sliding. So maybe we were happier. I think there's probably something to the idea that, the more you know, let's say the person who reads a lot of news and, you know, delves into facts about the world or whatever, you know, they're probably going to be a little less happy than the person who's just simply listening to music at that time or, engaging in sex or eating a wonderful meal or engaging in conversation with the child or a spouse. That's kind of where happiness is more easily found than in some of these other things. But, you know, I guess what we're discussing here today is that, you know, you can't just put everything on autopilot and, you know, go where your emotions take you or where the place that feels correct. Because, like I said, lizard brain with the more sophisticated brain wrapped around it. So just to a large degree, you know, we are basically like chimpanzees plus one, you know, and if we don't try to exercise the more rational and executive parts of our brain as much as possible, we're really going to miss the boat. We're probably going to shoot somebody in the head or we're going to, accidentally, clone mankind, or we're going to, let a new pandemic go from a rat to a human or other things that are just kind of wacky and misguided. You know, a lot of people, for example, they think that becoming wealthier is the most important thing they can do because they'll be much happier when they're wealthy. And evidence tends to show that's not probably true. They might be as happy as they currently are or a little less happy. But so I think we need to subject almost everything to as much rational analysis and reconsideration and these types of things as possible.
I was thinking about that quote a little bit, though, and I wonder, as we talked about in the very beginning of the conversation, sometimes at first glance, like ambiguity and uncertainty from an evolutionary thing, we don't care for it. But I do think there is, at some point right. in time, if you can navigate beyond that, I don't know, I tend to think maybe there is a bit more happiness. If we think on one side, certainty, and on the other side, instead of uncertainty, maybe just replace it with the word wonder, it can be a much more enjoyable place to navigate the world. I think of people of the past that you maybe look up in the sky and we know a lot more that's going on up there now today. But I don't know, does that take away a bit of the wonder from 1,000 years ago when people looked up in the sky?
Yeah. One thing I thought when you were saying that was I would predict that the person who was the most confident is probably the most content because they feel like they've checked that box. You know, they've figured that out. And then of course, some people, they make a habit out of trying to do that in every area of their life. I think that's probably a tempting thing to do, but I think a lot of error can come from that. And it can be very unwise to, you know, quote, foreclose on some of these contentious or dubious or these issues that are arguable and that are complicated. If we get concrete with our belief system or, you know, then I think it might be more comfortable, but one's going to be a lot more error prone in that sense. So me being an agnostic, for example, I think it's not really that fun might be better to belong to the atheist camp because they're sort of like a tribe, right? They think that Christians are wacky or whatever, or that believing in God is unfounded. And then, of course, you know, the believers, you could have, it could go from zealous to confident or happy or whatever. And those folks probably are a little more, it's like mollified or contented because they found something to believe in that really works for them and gives their life meaning. Agnostics have to sort of be comfortable with the idea that there is meaning in choosing not to decide. I don't know if you've ever heard the song Free Will by Rush, but if not, go look it up. It's a really interesting look at, you know, basically the lyricist says, I will choose free will. In other words, I will come to believe that I'm not dancing on the end of a puppet master's strings, and that everything is decided for me, and that all the rules have already been, you know, crystallized, and that I, you know, all I have to do is read it in the book. It's like, I'm going to choose free will. Whether or not Neil Peart, the lyricist of that song, was happy, I don't know. It seems as though he was. But I don't know if he would have been happier or less happy if he were more confident or less confident about some of these things he believed. But one thing you could say about Peart is that he definitely looked into things. He was a constant reader. He was very mentally vivacious, always talking with people and debating and learning and going out and experiencing. And I think one could hardly do better than that.
Well, our time is flown by. I appreciate you coming on to chat about the book. Where do you point people interested in learning more about you, the book, and if you could talk a little bit about your website and this quote database that you have as well? I think that would be great.
No, thanks. So since 2004, I've been interested in cataloging or collecting, doing various things with, you know, these values, what I call values of the wise, meaning what, in my opinion, are some of the values that wise people would be, you know, moved by, find meaning in, cherish, love, and can benefit from. So, you know, they're pretty standard values. You know, you got your truth, justice, and creativity, and dedication, things that are kind of inarguably virtues, and maybe some other things like humor or progressivism, integration, magnanimity. So it's just my take, my theory on what wisdom is based on, you know, who are these wise people and what can we learn from them. So I put together this thing I call the Wisdom Archive. It is a searchable database of quotations. I got 36,000 of them at this time, and I categorize each of them, that, you know, according to, based on my opinion, you know, what's the gender of the person who said the quote. Obviously, you got the name of the person. Each of the words in the quote are searchable, or, you know, identifiable. Where the person is generally from, kind of like sort of like a Western versus non-Western way to slice it. So if one is interested in, you know, thinking about some of these topics we've been discussing or other things in philosophy and psychology, personal growth, just go to the website valuesofthewise.com, and then under resources, you know, yes, I've got a blog and podcast and whatever, but there's also this searchable quotations database. It's very simple, free. There's no ads. And so it's kind of a good resource for writers or people who want to think or learn more about an individual. You know, maybe you want to know more about Voltaire. Maybe you want to know about African Americans who spoke about justice, or maybe, you know, Asian and Indian females who talked about, you know, transcendence. I don't know, whatever. You can just kind of mix and match all of the fields and the criteria and see what you get. And, you know, each search is kind of different based on what you would specify. And you can just go through them one by one. If you don't like it, skip it. If you like it, then, you know, write it down, copy it, do what you want with it, et cetera.
Well, cool. Lots of hours, I'm sure, invested in that. Appreciate you sharing it with the listeners. We'll link it in the show notes. I highly encourage you to check it out. Jason Murchie, thank you so much for coming on In Search of Wisdom. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. You can get the show notes and links to resources mentioned at perennialleader.com/podcast. If you're interested in learning more, subscribe to The Path. It's our free weekly newsletter. These are short reflections on wisdom for everyday life right to your inbox. And lastly, I urge you to put what you heard into practice. Until next time, be wise and be well.